I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
As we turn our attention to another major story, as we learned late yesterday that the senator from Connecticut, the former Senator Joe Lieberman, had died. We actually spoke with Joe Lieberman right here on Bloomberg. Kaylee and I did about 6 days ago on Balance of Power. This is an 82-year-old man. Of course, we've talked a lot about age in politics most recently, but this was a man who truly was working up until his last breath as co-chair of the group No Labels, which has been desperately searching for a candidate, as he told us just last week. Here he is.
We're still in pursuit of a couple of really good candidates. And we got to make a decision in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And when we do, hopefully we'll excite people. And they'll say, you know what? This is the third choice I've wanted.
The senator who went from a longtime pillar of the Democratic Party to an independent and, of course, ran as the vice presidential nominee alongside Al Gore in 2000. Has left us. He was 82. And we now bring in the governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont, who knew him awfully well. Governor, I appreciate your spending some time with us here. This is a politician who left your party. How do you want people to remember him?
I think I liberated Senator Lieberman. We had a pretty frisky primary going back about 16 years ago, and he ended up running as an independent, winning. And we shook hands. It was a debate about the war in Iraq, but you have a debate about the big issues of the day, then the people decide. And we've been close ever since. And we're going to have a memorial service for Senator Lieberman tomorrow. There's going to be a great outpouring of support. Look, he was old school, right? He had relationships on both sides of the aisle and, you know, had strong convictions. You know, some fit neatly within the Democratic Party, some less so. He was his own man. That's how he'll be known. He was his own man.
You beat him in that primary, of course. Did he do the right thing by moving on to run as an independent?
He had the right to run as an independent. He said he might run as an independent even during that primary. So, look, that was then, now's now. We shook hands at the end of that race. I saw him just a couple of months ago at the alfalfa dinner. We talked about the war in Iraq, where we disagreed. We talked about giving the Ukrainians the aid they need to support themselves, a place where we did agree. Mm-hmm.
It was the Iraq war aforementioned that seemed to either pull him away from the Democratic Party or I think he would characterize it as a party that was leaving him. He will be remembered for his foreign policy acumen. What did he bring to the Senate and to the country in that regard?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, the decision to invade Iraq back in 2003 was quite bipartisan. I was a little more of the outlier by saying I think it's the wrong decision to make. But more importantly, remember Joe Lieberman for the state of Connecticut. He served us going back as a state senator in 1970. And for decades, he was there fighting on behalf of the people of the state. And a whole variety of issues that he cared deeply about. The environment, he was such a leader there. LGBTQ issues. Back before they were less mainstream, he had the courage to stand up and make a difference there as well. He obviously was a strong defender of our defense system. We have some contractors here in the state. He fought hard to make sure our Navy base and submarines stayed here in Connecticut.
Well, that's a lot. He also continued to stay active in politics following his retirement as a lawmaker. And I've been awfully compelled by his journey with this group, No Labels. We just played a snippet of our conversation with him from just last week. A lot of people have been criticizing him, a lot of Democrats, for trying to spoil this race. When we spoke with him, he seemed to genuinely think that he was doing something in the name of democracy. What do you think?
I think you can be independent-minded and a man of your own convictions within the Democratic Party or within the Republican Party. I think it's a little confusing to bring in a lot of outside parties. I think that's probably not that helpful. I'm not sure I agreed on that. He certainly was somebody who was able to maintain his strong independence and stay true to himself within the Democratic Party for so many years.
Well, he's obviously the end of an era for a lot of folks in Connecticut, but also here in Washington, Governor. I wonder if you can speak to the different era that we are in now, because we're seeing an important generational turnover that a lot of people are calling for on the presidential level. It may not have happened yet, but it's certainly been happening on the legislative level. What is that era that Joe Lieberman represented?
I think it was more collegial. That's when people spent a lot more time together on both sides of the aisle. They ate meals together. They traveled together on a lot of these missions. That's where Joe became quite close with Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham, the three amigos.
Yeah.
Those relationships were powerful. I find today the relationships are less there. It's more ideological. That's an era I miss.
I've got to ask you, Governor, this can just stay between us if you want. Should John McCain have run with Joe Lieberman? This has been debated up and down. We all know how that race ended. He wanted his friend to run with him. And at the time, it seemed outrageous, the idea, just like it would now of a Republican tapping a former Democrat. What do you think about it?
I think in hindsight, John McCain would have been much better off with Joe Lieberman as a running mate.
Would you have supported that ticket? You wouldn't be allowed to do that as a Democrat, right?
Not a question of allowed to do it. I wouldn't have supported it. Remember, I came into this game thinking that, George Bush's invasion of Iraq was a terrible thing, not just for that country, but for peace in the Middle East. So I was not going to be supporting that ticket, but I think it would have been a stronger ticket.
That's fascinating. We can have this conversation now with Governor Ned Lamont of Connecticut. And I really appreciate your candor on this, Governor. When's the last time you talked to Joe Lieberman?
You know, we got together at the alfalfa dinner down in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, and I had a chance to catch up briefly. And we promised we were going to get together soon. Unfortunately, it's at his memorial service tomorrow.
Well, we were all struck by his demeanor and the passion that he was still showing to the cause when we spoke with him just last week. This is, of course, due to complications from a fall. He was still looking pretty good and still had his wits about him, didn't he?
I love it. I mean, I'm a guy who just turned 70, so I love to see these folks, playing it up at the top of their game. Here he was at 82, still making a difference. I say go for it.
It's not every day we spend time with the governor of Connecticut, and I have to ask you a couple of things while you're with us in our remaining a couple of minutes here, Governor Lamont. This general election campaign that we've referred to by way of No Labels is well underway now. Joe Biden's going to be in New York tonight with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. I presume that you're supporting this ticket. What's your read on the race from your perch in Connecticut?
My read is that America usually does the right thing after exhausting all the other options. And I think the right thing is going to be Joe Biden. I think people know him. I think people trust him. I think especially in this very topsy-turvy world, our allies need to know there's America that they can count upon as the indispensable nation. It'll be President Joe Biden.
Does Bill Clinton help the party at this point? I've been describing this as the Mount Rushmore of Democratic politics, but of course, Barack Obama brings a lot to Joe Biden. Their relationship was important. And there are a lot of progressive Democrats who think Bill Clinton carries too much baggage to be helpful. Maybe it's a fundraising story. Is that something you've considered?
Look, I think the three of them standing arm in arm together, I think they represent the best traditions of America. The Republican Party is pretty fractured right now. You're not going to see that story with former President Trump. I think it's important. You know, I know what Joe Biden stands for. He was vice president to Barack Obama. And Bill Clinton is part of that trio. I think it's important. It tells the story of the consistency of American values.
They say all news is local, Governor, and I'm a Putnam, Connecticut boy. But I've got to ask you about this new congestion tax in New York. That's a lot of your taxpayers, a lot of people who live in Connecticut who are potentially going to be paying a lot more money to go south of 60th Street. Is it fair?
Well, I'm sorry about your drive from Putnam, and it will cost you a little bit of extra money. I'm the one state that doesn't have tolls. Everybody else on the Eastern Seaboard has tolls, including New York. Then you go through New Jersey, where they're raising. Unfortunately, you've got to pay for transportation, or you can avoid the tolls and take public transportation.
Yeah. So you don't see a problem with it in terms of folks being penalized for living in Connecticut or New Jersey?
Hey, look, the politics of it stinks, no question about it. But you've got to upgrade that transportation system and the subway system in New York. Yeah. So I'm not going to find fault.
Well, Governor Ned Lamont, I appreciate you're spending some time with us today on Bloomberg, your reflections on Joe Lieberman and the stories of the day. Good luck to your Huskies tonight.
It's going to be a big game tonight. Thanks, Joe.
We'll be watching. Come back and see you soon. On the fastest show in politics, we have a lot more to follow here. Matt Bennett's going to chime in a little bit later from Third Way on the no labels issue, as well as what in the world is happening to RFK Jr.'s campaign and whether he can get on the ballot in all 50 states. Is he the real spoiler here? Chris Christie, by the way, says no to no labels. We'll have a lot more on it coming up next here on Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Great to have you with us. Welcome to Bloomberg Radio, YouTube, and the satellite. As we consider news now from the former governor of New Jersey, thanks but no thanks. How's this for a statement? I appreciate the encouragement from Chris Christie. This is about a potential run on no labels. And I will tell you, we had it on pretty darn good sources that this might actually happen as recently as last week when we spoke with the now late Joe Lieberman. The statement goes on to write, I also believe that if there is not a pathway to win, and if my candidacy is in any way, shape, or form helping Donald Trump become president again, then it is not the way forward, unquote. I thought maybe Matt Bennett had written that for him. Of course, one of our frequent Democratic panelists here on the program, Matt Bennett at Third Way, is with us right now because Third Way has been working overtime to talk about this no labels effort. And I think I could dare say, Matt, snuff it out. Is this the end? We lost Joe Lieberman, and I want to be sensitive here. I'm trying to be delicate around this. But he was a driving force behind this group. And now the last great hope, it seems, of a candidate in Chris Christie has said no. Are we done?
We don't know. It's a free country. If No Labels wants to go forward, they can find somebody to lead their ticket. They can. And at least so far, they are not saying anything about folding their tent. But to your point, they've suffered two serious blows. One, the tragic loss of Senator Lieberman, who we all mourn as a great leader for this country, was also their founding chairman and was a driving force behind the group. But he didn't run it day to day. It's being run by their founder and CEO, Nancy Jacobson, and really this is going to be up to her. But the bigger problem, as you point out, is that they cannot find an A-list candidate. They can't even find a B-list candidate. They were floating a former lieutenant governor as their potential presidential candidate a couple of weeks ago. So it's tough there.
The great Jeff Duncan campaign that wasn't. Okay. This, by the way, was initially reported by the Washington Post, the Christie story. If we can't get a candidate, that also means we probably can't get on the ballot in most places, correct?
That's right. They had said that they would have ballot access by the end of last year in 34 states. They now have it in 18. So they're way behind predictions. And there's a bunch of states where they can't even begin to get on the ballot until they name a candidate because of state rules. So they're really up against it. In fact, in New York, they face a looming deadline in a couple of weeks where they must have a candidate and they must submit their signatures. And it does not appear that they're ready to do that. So there's some real questions about the logistics here. If they do pick a candidate, they are going to be handing that person an enormously difficult set of problems, not only to compete with a current president, a former president, and a Kennedy, but also to gain ballot access in most places.
Let's talk about a Kennedy. Because I want to ask you about this running mate. I'm fascinated by this whole story, the Nicole Shanahan element. And I've read some commentary in the wild already that came from you, so I think I know where you are on this. But in terms of no labels, taking a look at RFK Jr., is that a possibility?
I don't think so. RFK Jr. does not fit any of the metrics that no labels had set for itself around kind of a unity ticket. And I'm not sure RFK Jr. would be interested in the No Labels endorsement at this point. So I doubt it'll be them, the Kennedy-Shanahan team. If No Labels goes forward, it'll be probably with somebody far less prominent than Kennedy.
What does our audience need to know about Nicole Shanahan? This choice is interesting to me, and folks like yourself have tried to make clear that this is about ballot access. Tell us why.
Without a doubt. I mean, Nicole Shanahan has three qualities. She is over the age of 35 and born in the United States, which means she is constitutionally able to become vice president. And she's rich. She's got a lot of money. She is the former wife of one of the Google founders. And that allows them great flexibility, because if you are the candidate or one of the candidates on a presidential ticket, you can give your campaign unlimited contributions. That's not true of anyone else in the presidential context. They're limited to $2,900 a person, but Shanahan can write enormous checks. And if they're going to be on the ballot everywhere, or even most places, they're going to need those checks, and they're going to need them right away because they're kind of behind the eight ball. So it seems to me, no doubt, they pick this woman because of her money.
Well, sounds kind of smart then, right? She was married till last year to Sergey Brin, who you referenced, the Google co-founder, who has a fortune estimated by Bloomberg News at $129 billion. What could that mean for the campaign?
Unless she has very bad lawyers, she's got a lot of that money. So, I think it's smart from a political perspective because money helps in politics. But this is somebody that would be a heartbeat away from the presidency, and she has absolutely no qualifications whatsoever to be president of the United States. I mean, she's a lawyer and she's a financier of movies and stuff. I mean, she has literally no qualifications. And if you think about it, even the least qualified vice presidential candidates like Dan Quayle and Sarah Palin, at least they've been senators and governors. I mean, she's done nothing.
Yeah, right. Wow. Fascinating to see Donald Trump try to frame RFK as a super lib to the left of Joe Biden, he says. It reminds me of Democrats buying ads to lift up the MAGA candidate. Is he worried about RFK Jr. taking votes away?
I don't think Trump is spending a lot of time worrying about this, and he's probably right not to.
No?
But this strategy is wise on his part. I mean, what he really wants to do is ensure that RFK hurts Biden. And at the moment, it appears that that's the likely scenario. I mean, Trump's core support is very solid. It's low. His ceiling is pretty low, but his floor is really hard. And so it's unlikely that RFK or any other third-party candidate is going to hurt him much, but they definitely could hurt Biden.
Spending time with Matt Bennett from Third Way, where he's executive vice president and a frequent, as I mentioned, Democratic analyst on our panels here. Matt, it's not lost on me, and our viewers looking at you on YouTube here see that Hillary banner in the background. I was at that convention when they made those. And I'm just wondering, ahead of Joe Biden's appearance tonight with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, I know this is about the three presidents. Are you surprised that Hillary is not a bigger part of this? Are you surprised that Bill Clinton is?
No, I'm not surprised by either of those things. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a huge and strong supporter of Joe Biden, and I have no doubt that she will do everything in her power to help him. But tonight was, you know, the president's, and she's not a president. She came pretty close, you know, about 40,000 votes, but she's not a former president. So I don't think it's a surprise. I'm also not the least bit surprised that Bill Clinton is helping Joe Biden. They're close allies. They always have been. Bill Clinton has been an advisor to President Biden throughout his time in office. And so I think this is a very natural thing that's happening tonight.
Yeah, we've actually, there's been reporting he talks to Bill Clinton more often than Barack Obama. I'm just, you know, thinking about the Me Too stuff. Just young people look at Bill Clinton, Matt, a lot differently than baby boomers do. Does he bring baggage to the stage, or you just don't look at it like that, knowing his fundraising prowess?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when you compare, well, when you think about this in the context of this presidential election, you have one of the major party candidates who has been found by a court to be guilty of rape. So, look, I mean, I understand that there's some baggage connected to Clinton, but not that. And also, I think he brings a lot of upside with him as well. He's a brilliant political mind, and he remains pretty popular, certainly among the Democratic base. So I think he's really going to help.
And a monster organizer, I know, when it comes to raising money. Certainly the influence through the Clinton Global Initiative is something that we have to acknowledge. Matt, I'm really glad you could join us today. Great to have you back. Come see us again in studio soon. Matt Bennett at Third Way, where they have been awfully busy on this no labels issue.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
She is Katie Lyons. I'm Joe Matthew. We're in Washington. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio. It's great to have you with us today. As we turn back to the campaign trail, Kaylee, we've been talking about this monster event tonight at Radio City. Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, both on stage with the president of the United States. They're going to raise $25 million, thanks in part to a photo line. If you want a photograph with all three, by the way, we're told by our own Josh Wingrove that Annie Leibovitz herself is going to be taking the photographs. $100,000 for one picture. That's how you get that kind of money. And to your point, that's what, twice what Donald Trump pulled in a month, something like that?
$20 million he pulled in February, more than what Donald Trump. Entire month.
So one night versus million. One month. Yeah. Remarkable. With our eyes on the trail, I'm glad to say Cliff Young is with us from Ipsos. We refer to his polling and his research so often, and we've got a lot of questions for Cliff today. It's great to see you. Welcome back to the table. Nice to see you in Washington today.
It's great to be here.
So this fundraiser tonight brings our attention back to a general election campaign that everyone seems to have settled on. I'm going to ask you some questions about RFK Jr., but what we're hearing from No Labels is nobody wants to run. Are you settled on Trump v. Biden?
I think it's going to be Trump v. Biden. There could be a third candidate, but those are the two primary front runners on each side. We're ratcheting up now, and we have a campaign. We have a dispute in front of us.
Well, as we talk about Trump and Biden, Joe mentioned at the very top of the hour that we did get consumer sentiment data today. It's the highest since 2021. It's improving. We actually saw the biggest improvement within a month going back to 2022. It does seem like feelings around the economy are starting to improve. The question is, does Biden's prospects really improve with them? How close is that connection, really?
Yeah, this campaign, this electoral year was always going to be a very close one. We never had any doubt in respect to that. Obviously, time's not in Biden's favor. Anytime an incumbent's down because of the economy, the question is, can you gain that ground quickly enough? But what's happening now is what we expect. And the economy's improving. People perceive that. And we're beginning to see, at least on the Biden side, glimmers of hope when it comes to numbers.
Fascinating. The RFK factor is a real one, or at least it could be. You did some research just about a week ago on this. He has since named a running mate, and we can talk more about the direction of his campaign. But when I start hearing Donald Trump try to frame the narrative around RFK Jr., calling him left of Joe Biden, I'm starting to think that he's worried about this. Should he take it seriously?
He should. Listen, first and foremost, RFK represents a disaffected middle, whether it be 10%, 16%, somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. At Ipsos, sometimes we ask the question without the name, a nondescript third-party individual, we get 10%.
Just option C.
It's just option, the other option,
anyone.
Right, beside the two.
Anyone.
Anyone else but these two, right? But ultimately, there is a disaffected middle, mm-hmm. right? But that disaffected middle tends to be a little right of center, at least by our polling, tends to be a little bit more conservative, tends to be a little bit more female,
sure.
a little bit more suburban. Maybe the Dobbs decision had an effect. So I think there should be worries on Trump's side. Obviously, it's Biden's job to mobilize these disaffected voters because they're really more likely to be his voters than Trump's. But that said, it makes total sense the way in which Trump is framing it today.
Well, you talk about mobilization of these voters, and I wonder if the question we should be asking is not how many people will turn out to vote for RFK Jr. or any third-party candidate, whatever option C, or whether they're just going to decide not to vote. Because theoretically, I just wonder if the choice is more, do I vote or do I vote for this other person rather than do I vote for this other person over Trump or Biden? Because are these individuals going to vote for Trump or Biden in any case?
Yeah, it's both, right? That third option in part represents aspirations. And so some of those that aspire to a third-party candidate won't vote on election day. Polling tends to overstate the third-party candidate, both in the United States and around the world. We see that everywhere. I think it will minimize a bit, narrow a bit. It'll come down to sort of, I think, single-digit numbers by election day. But ultimately, it represents both those that would not vote and those that would want to vote for a third-party candidate. Mm-hmm.
Nicole Shanahan is his pick for running mate. Of course, is married till just last year to Sergey Brin, worth $129 billion. She is going to have the ability to donate an unlimited amount of cash as an actual candidate on the ticket to this campaign. Does that make it more legitimate? Are you expecting it to be on the ballot in all 50 states?
It's very, very difficult to get on the ballot in all 50 states, especially now. It takes time, and there are a lot of limitations, a lot of barriers to entry when it comes to third-party candidates getting on the ballot. Obviously, money helps, and a lot of money helps even more.
That's right.
But ultimately, it's going to be about resonance with public opinion. And once again, we can't minimize the importance of the anti-vote, the anti-Trump vote, the anti-Biden vote. At the end of the day, you might be disaffected, but do you really want Trump to win? Or do you really want Biden to win? Are you really going to throw away your vote when it comes to your anti-candidate feelings?
Mm-hmm. I often get told when I ask questions about voter sentiment that not everyone's paying as much attention as we are here in Washington. Obviously, we've been enmeshed in this for what feels like forever, and we will continue to be so. But a lot of people are probably just now tuning in, seeing that there is someone with the Kennedy name who is running. And I just wonder to what extent you think the support he may be drawing now will actually be lasting it once the public gets to know him better, whether it is just kind of a name recognition thing we may be seeing right now.
I think it's partially that. Once again, our experience, whether it be in the United States or in other countries with third-party candidates, they tend to taper off as you get closer to Election Day. And it is the case that people are not paying attention at this point. Therefore, we should be very careful with the horse race polls. The horse race polls are fuzzy at best. Other indicators like the main problem and approval ratings are probably better leading indicators of what will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, we have to understand where we are. We're 7 months out.
Kaylee mentions consumer sentiment today. Our Bloomberg News poll that came out a couple of days ago actually showed improvement in the seven swing states, or at least several key states for Joe Biden, including Wisconsin. Is the trajectory in his favor based on your research? You look a couple of months down the road, where is he going to be?
I expect this trend. These elections in the United States are very, very close presidential elections. We have to remember that historically speaking. There's no way that Trump was going to win by as much as the polls are suggesting. This was a lag effect, in my opinion, inertial effect of inflation and the economy is improving, and that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing sort of glimmers of hope in some ways when it comes to the economy. You're less likely to punish the executive in power at the time, that is Biden at this point. And your numbers and all the numbers are suggesting this more positive trend for the Biden camp.
All right, Cliff Young of Ipsos, always great to have you here in our Washington studio. We appreciate your time, and it's worth considering, Joe, as we continue to get this economic data in, including tomorrow when you and I won't be working because it is a holiday and the markets will be closed, but we're still going to get PCE data and hear from Chairman Powell. And we know that interest rates and where they are come November when voters are heading to the polls could make a massive difference.
That's absolutely right. We'll have special coverage on Bloomberg Radio 8:30 when that PCE data are released, and we'll be, of course, carrying that into next week, this endless conversation about the economy.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I wouldn't call this a stealth rally because it's been going on for some time, but we're back at the highest level since October.
Isn't that something?
For WTI. Almost $83 a barrel. And obviously that is going to translate to the price paid at the pump, a pretty visible sign of inflation to the American people.
You wonder when the oil stocks start to follow. Well, I guess they've started to pop a little bit. But yeah, so I paid $3.29 to fill up yesterday.
Okay.
In Northern Virginia, so D.C. area. AAA has got a forecast of $4 this summer. We're back to a four handle right when people are starting to make up their minds or at least pay attention to this presidential cycle.
Yeah, not great news for President Biden, who, of course, throughout his administration has been fighting very hard against higher oil prices, including the tapping of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, encouraging American oil companies as well as OPEC, other countries, to pump more oil.
We talked to Bob McNally quite a bit around that time when they were draining a good chunk of the SPR. Rapidan Energy is his company where he's president, formerly in the Bush White House, and he's with us now, Bob. It's good to see you. Do you buy into this $4 a gallon forecast for summer?
Hi, Joe and Kaylee. In many parts of the country, yes. You know, Rapidan's forecast on an annual average basis, or I should say national average basis, is more like 380, but 380 nationally is still, you know, in some swing states like Arizona and Nevada, that's a four handle, as you heard. In California, it's way above. So, you know, I think a lot of folks are going to be seeing $4 a gallon, if not the whole country. You get the Midwest, down to Texas, the lower East Coast, maybe it'd be a little less. But yeah, a lot of folks are going to be seeing $4.
Well, it raises the question as to why exactly this is happening. When prices had been coming down, now they're heading back up potentially to these levels. Is this an issue of the economy is still doing much better than thought, so demand is staying strong, or is it an issue of supply, or is it both and, Bob?
I think it's mainly on the demand side with some geopolitical risk in there. As always, the most important determinant of what we pay at the pump is the price of global crude oil. And crude oil has been finding its footing here after selling off sharp late last year. Why? There's confidence in a soft landing. Macroeconomic factors have had a big influence on oil prices, crude oil. Folks are feeling better about a soft landing here. We even had some good Chinese data. And then we're starting to see the oil market tighten up. Inventories are drawing. Demand is good, even for gasoline in places like Europe. Demand is not bad. And so as those inventory draws show up, OPEC Plus has been extending its cuts, and now a little bit of geopolitical risk, not a lot, just a little bit with the Ukrainians hitting Russian refineries and the Red Sea. we're starting to see a solid base and a decent rally here. I don't expect it to go too much higher unless things get much worse in the Middle East, but we think oil has sort of found its footing, crude oil, and where crude oil goes, pump prices follow.
There were a lot of questions, Bob, following the bridge collapse this week in Baltimore about what impact that may or may not have on energy prices, knowing how much coal is coming out of that port. Do you have an answer to that question? Is this a factor or not?
You know, it's a big deal for coal just because that's one of the biggest coal export ports we have. So that's the biggest
energy. Does that bleed over into oil prices?
No, not really. No. Baltimore, it gets its gasoline and diesel mainly from the Colonial Pipeline. It does import some asphalt into Baltimore, but they'll route that in through some other ports like Norfolk. So I think it's a local issue. Unfortunately, with that tragedy, it's not even a regional, much less a national issue we should worry about for oil prices.
Well, and if anything, the fact that there are so many containers trying to import and export out of Baltimore and all of the ports, for that matter, on the eastern seaboard may just underscore how intense global trade is and how much demand there still is for goods all around the world, which may just reinforce the higher prices as well, kind of being a signal of the more resilient economy that we are talking about. And of course, all of this does come back for us here in Washington to politics. We know that Biden has been plagued by high energy prices and prices at the pump. We talked about some of the things he tried to do to address that. What you hear on the other side of the aisle, including from his opponent in November, or presumed opponent, Donald Trump, is that American energy needs to be unleashed. And Bob, I believe we already were, at least in 2023, we'll see if it's the case again this year, pumping a record amount of oil here in the U.S. So when we are talking about American energy being unleashed, what exactly would that mean?
I think President Trump is talking about removing unnecessary or burdensome restrictions on developing new oil resources, new refining capacity, pipelines, and that type of thing, more with a long-term view. To your point, Kaylee, you're exactly right. Look, being a big producer doesn't mean you get to control the price at the pump. President Trump found that out. President Biden's finding that out. President Bush found that out. Big doesn't mean stable prices or comfortable prices, because the United States is basically a price taker in the global oil market, no matter how much oil we produce. The real, you know, to paraphrase, I'm sorry, but Mao Zedong, power in the global oil market flows through the barrel of spare production capacity. And that's mainly in Saudi Arabia. That's wielded by OPEC Plus. They have more pricing power than the president, no matter how much we produce here. It's a tough truth for politicians to accept. You would think if we're a big producer, we ought to be able to keep gasoline at $3.20 forever. Doesn't work that way.
Bob, did we miss our opportunity to refill the SPR?
Yeah, I think we made a mistake in selling, especially that 180 million barrels. We sold way too much. To its credit, Joe, the administration has been putting oil back in. I think they realized that this thing is too low with all the mayhem we have in the world. And so they're putting in 3-4 or so a million a month. However, they said, look, if prices keep rising, we're going to stop filling the SPR. And I'm afraid that's a real chance here. So we should have avoided the sale. It's good that DOE is refilling. Be great if we refilled faster. But if prices start rising here, they'll probably stop. And that's understandable, too. What would be a big mistake is to, again, use it as an election ploy and spill it again to release another 60 or 90 million barrels just because gasoline prices approach your $4 handle. That would be just really unfortunate.
What about over the longer term, as you talk about the opportunity to fill up the SPR? What if we actually need it, not for price control, but for some kind of emergency? What kind of situation are we going to be in if it's drained to a large extent?
We're in trouble. We have drained our SPR to 40-year lows, and it will be costly to refill it anywhere close to the 600 plus million barrels, much less the 700 million barrels where we got it to in the Bush administration. And as you mentioned, it's all about responding to a disruption. So if we get a few years down the road, demand doesn't peak, things are getting frothy, OPEC spare capacity goes down and we have a conflict in the Arabian Gulf or somewhere else, we won't have that emergency buffer. That's why I think, again, I'll give them credit. To their credit, DOE is saying this thing is too low for a dangerous, volatile oil world. We need to refill it. But I'm afraid there's not political will on either side of the aisle, really, to refill it fast enough to give us that buffer later this decade. We'll miss it.
All right. We have to leave it on that note. But Bob McNally of Rapidan Energy, thank you so much, as always, for joining us on Bloomberg Television and Radio as we talk about energy, which certainly is a factor in this electoral cycle. Joe, it's something we hear a lot about from both sides. And we know, once again, prices at the pump do have an influence on voter sentiment, how they're feeling about the economy as they prepare to decide who they want to vote for president. But energy and the economy is on what is a long list of issues that may change the minds of voters.
Well, that's for sure. And then we see consumer sentiment today at the highest level since July, which you were smart to invoke earlier. Rick Davis, one of our political analysts who was on with us earlier this hour, always tells it's a more reliable poll than the polls. So even as oil prices increase, we're seeing sentiment on the rise as well. And I'm sure it's confounding some of the, the economic minds inside the White House.
Yeah, although maybe both of that is a sign of a more resilient economy than thought. People might be feeling better about the economy because they still have their jobs.
Right.
The economy is still growing. They can maybe afford the higher gas as their wages are rising. Mm-hmm. But definitely something of a puzzle. And we know that the economy is often top of mind, or at least up there on the list for voters. Yeah. But we've found out throughout this primary cycle, and now that we're effectively in the general election, that immigration and the border sometimes is equal to or even above that issue in many of these states.
That's for sure. That's what our polling has brought to us. And as we learned on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire, that was the case in both of those primaries. So it will certainly be near the top, if not the most important issue in the general election campaign. So not lost on us here. And that's why our bureau chief in Washington, Peggy Collins, made tracks to the border, just returned recently from our southwest border in Texas. She's with us at the table now. Peggy, it's great to see you. This is going to be featured in our Big Take podcast, Big Take DC podcast to be specific, that drops later today. I have no idea what's in store for us. What did you learn on your trip?
Well, it was a really impactful trip. As you were saying, Joe, we really wanted to go down to the border and talk to the people on multiple sides of the issue there, because it has become, other than the economy, one of the top two issues that voters are citing in terms of what matters most to them in this election in November. And one of the things that really stood out when we were there was how porous the border is, really. When you're there, you really see how close we are to Mexico, and that the river is really the border. It almost felt at some points like you could toss a baseball across and hit Mexico. One of the other things that really stood out is how much of a multi-pronged effort it is to try and deal with the crisis of so many people coming across the border from places in Latin America. I mean, I went up in a helicopter with some people to try and see like where they're seeing migrants crossing and how they're trying to deal with them on ranchers' land, for example. There's boats that are traversing back and forth. There's people who are waiting for the migrants to potentially touch ground on U.S. soil and then process them. There's nonprofits that are working with people who are coming across the border. There's city officials. There's religious people. It really is like a multi-pronged effort. And time again, we heard from people two key things. One, that it is a humanitarian crisis. And two, that small towns like Eagle Pass, Texas, where we were, really need help because they're small border towns. And they're dealing with an incredible volume of people that are coming across.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that for that reason, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, has been really at the forefront of this issue, having the state of Texas do things that are legally in question now in regard to being able to detain people suspected of being having migrated over illegally. What sense did you get of the way that Texas is handling it and how much cooperation there really is at the federal level with what the state is doing?
So when we were there, actually, we went out with the Texas Department of Safety and we traveled along, drove along the border. And when you're actually with them, we don't really sense a lot of tension between the feds and the state, right? But Texas has taken over this area right underneath a bridge that is a legitimate border crossing in Eagle Pass, Texas. It's Shelby Park. And basically, there's a golf course there and there's a bridge and people traverse it every day from Mexico to the U.S., but also Texas, the state, has taken it over because they say they need more help and they need to get control over this. And it is difficult to see. I mean, there's a lot of Constantiner wire and razor wire, barbed wire up and down for miles in this Shelby Park area, but also up in some private lands. And you see, we went to see some of the places where the migrants have been able to cross because there's an opening in the barbed wire. Mm-hmm. And there's just piles and piles and piles of clothes. When they cross the river, they take off their wet clothes and then they keep heading on. But there's diapers, there's toothbrushes, there's clothes, there's kids' backpacks, there's babies' booties. I mean, it's really human when you see it.
That's really something. As you bring this to life for us, you were at Eagle Pass, you said, the center of the standoff, as our Texas Bureau Chief Julie Fine refers to it. I think you guys were together on this trip.
We were.
You already answered part of my question. I was going to ask you if you could see the razor wire, if you could see the buoys and some of these other obstacles that have been put in place that have been considered very controversial from a place where an average citizen or a journalist could go. Was that all in your view?
We did see it, yes. It is striking to see it. You know, you look over at Mexico at points, yeah, and there's cows and horses and men fishing, and then you stand on the U.S. side and you're looking right in the face of, you know, barbed wire. Yeah. So many different people around those that we talked to, both law enforcement and people who were working with the migrants and the migrants themselves, did say that they're really trying to find a solution here because they understand how human it is.
It drops today. The Bloomberg Big Take DC podcast with the great help of Peggy Collins. Thanks, Peggy, for being with us.
This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.